Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. How does beauty point to God? Ken will explore the aesthetic argument today in part one of two podcasts on this topic. Ken, I'm looking forward to this series. I know you're exploring even the very idea of what beauty is. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're going to take a careful look at what Christians through the centuries have called the aesthetic argument. And so in our first program here, I want to make that case. And then kind of in our second program, we'll talk about how beauty may be used in terms of evangelism and apologetics.
All right. Sounds practical, useful. So we're ready to go.
Well, let me begin by saying that Christians for centuries have talked about what we call the three transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty. And what that means in a Christian context is that God is himself truth. God doesn't have truth. God is truth by his very nature. God is goodness. God is beauty. And when God created the universe, he imbued that creation with traces of himself. And so what we discover in nature and in our own conscience and various ways of looking at ourselves is that we discover truth, goodness, and beauty. And just to lay down a brief biblical basis for this idea, the Bible talks a lot about God being truth. In fact, in the New Testament, John 14, 6, it says that Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So when you encounter Christ, you're not encountering merely an individual person who lived in the first century. You're encountering truth incarnate. Mm-hmm. And I like the passage in Psalm 119, verse 160. This is one of the longer Psalms. It says, all your words are true. All your righteous laws are eternal. So in a Christian context, God's nature is reflected in his laws, in his commandments. And here we discover that everything God says is true. And that truth, that veracity carries over into God's word. And so all truth is God's truth. That's a way of putting it. In terms of goodness, here's Psalm 100, verse 5, for the Lord is good and his love endures forever. His faithfulness continues throughout all generations. Again, the Lord, his nature is goodness. And then beauty, I think this is an intriguing passage, again, from the Psalms, chapter 27, verse 4. It says, one thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. So God is truth itself. God is goodness itself, beauty itself. And these are one of the many attributes of God. And just as God created the world with logos, logic, and nomos, laws, he created the world with truth, goodness, and beauty. And thus, Christians should expect to discover, if Christianity is right, if our worldview is correct, we should expect to discover truth, goodness, and beauty in the world in which we experience. Let me stop there for a moment. Joe or Dave, anything you want me to clarify before we kind of move in the direction of beauty?
I'm tracking with you.
Yeah, I think it's great. I just think it's interesting that you commented in the past that these three transcendent categories are not the categories that people discuss today. It seems like gender and, what are the three that you would name?
Yeah, race, gender, and class.
There you go.
And I think that's correct. I think that in some respects, we may be living in a post-Christian world, a post-Christian society. That's a lot to unpackage there. But it does seem that what some would call identity politics is the prism today. Well, let me then talk a little bit about beauty. I want to talk about how Christians look at beauty, and then I want to make an argument based upon beauty. But I want to begin by talking a little bit about an interesting program that I saw one of the Catholic channels, EWTN, Eternal Word Network. They had a program about the great works of art that are housed in the Vatican museums. And I didn't even know there are multiple museums. I thought there was one big museum, but there are multiple Vatican museums. And what caught my eye is that the museum benefactors say that part of their mission is to promote, and here it is, evangelism through beauty. Now, I want to pick that up again in our next program as we talk about how beauty might be used to draw people to the Christian faith. But what I want to simply say now is that I think the Vatican is expressing an aesthetic argument that can be made for God's existence. And, you know, one way to frame that argument, and this is a common way that I do apologetics, it is to say that God's existence provides the best explanation for the world's beauty. Now again, that's a very common kind of abductive way of reasoning that you ask, you know, how do you know your worldview is true? And one of the tests that you would explore is, well, does your worldview do a good job of accounting for the most meaningful realities in the world? And, you know, in the last 10 years on Straight Thinking, we've talked about how God accounts well for the cosmos, the fact that it had a beginning, that it appears to be fine-tuned. It accounts well for the human condition. Humans are, in the words of Blaise Pascal, great and wretched. It accounts for ethics, abstractions, and of course, Christianity makes sense of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, we could extend that inference to the best explanation. And again, I'll talk a bit more about this in a few minutes. We could extend that explanation to God. If God exists, then beauty makes sense. So let me kind of do a little presentation on aesthetics, and then we'll move to the argument. Dave, you and I went to England a couple years ago on a wonderful time taking some of the RTB people with us, and we got to visit Oxford University. We got to visit the Kilns, which was the home of C.S. Lewis, and it was a great trip. We got to go on bus trips and talk about great ideas. But I remember... Dave, I remember visiting a couple Anglo-Catholic cathedrals, and I remember one time you said to me, you know, what do you think of this place? And my response was, I just want to get on my knees and worship God. And, you know, if you think back to the Middle Ages, and of course, that was the thing I was thinking of walking through the grounds of Oxford. This university is almost 1,000 years old. You know, it's still one of the most remarkable universities in the world today. But in the Middle Ages, there were a lot of people who were not literate. And the churches would often use architecture and art to try to convey the Christian story. That they were, instead of using words, they were using images to convey the Christian story. And I have personally found that I think beauty is an underutilized element often in Christianity. And so these Anglo-Catholic churches were very, very impressive to me. They reflected what I think, is the glory of God. Now, let's just do a little discussion of aesthetics. Aesthetics involves the study of beauty, taste, and art. It asks lots of questions like what is beauty? Is beauty merely in the eye of the subjective beholder? I want to come back to that. That's a really critical idea. You know, is there an objective basis for beauty? Or is beauty merely subjective? And again, that'll be an important discussion both in this program and the next. And then, of course, maybe something people have not thought of. You know, we talk about truth, goodness, and beauty. How about falseness and badness and ugliness? What does that do? Just as people sometimes say, well, you say God is good, but what about evil, pain, and suffering? Some people would say, you know, you say God is beautiful, but what about the things in the world that are not? So these questions, I think, have real relevance, not only for the way we think about aesthetics, but the way we think about the Christian worldview. Now, philosophers ask further questions. Why do human beings have an aesthetic and creative sense? In the animal kingdom, it either doesn't exist or it exists in a very limited way. You know, birds build nests and, you know, you see some kind of, but is that aesthetics or is that merely need? You could also relate aesthetics to moral values. You know, in worldview thinking, we ask, what's your view of God? What's your view of reality? What's your view of knowledge? But we may also ask, what's your view of goodness? And what's your view of aesthetics? When it comes to aesthetics in Christianity, the simple message of historic Christianity is that God is the source or the ground of all beauty. It either comes directly from his creative hand, or it comes secondarily through making us in the image of God, and then we're able to, you know, create beauty. So I would relate that question of beauty to the Imago Dei. Now, I think this is an interesting point, and I agree with it. I think we can say that we don't create beauty. We create art that reflects beauty. Beauty is one of those transcendentals. It's eternal. It is throughout the world. We don't create beauty. We can create art, and it reflects that beauty. And of course, my point there would be, beauty is not a subjective thing. Beauty is an objective thing. Now whether I like the art or not, that's a matter of subjective taste. And, Dave and Joe and I have talked about music before. I think all three of us recognize that music is a remarkable artistic element that seems to permeate human existence, but we may differ over the kind of music that we like. Again, we'll come back to that a little bit later when we talk about those kinds of things. So we've talked a little bit about the transcendental, again, the truth, goodness, and beauty. And therefore, God is a designer. God is an engineer. God is responsible for the intelligibility of the world. You want to call him a mathematician, that would be fine. But I think we also have to recognize that he's a playful artist. I would encourage our listeners to give some consideration. I mean, what do you think your experience is going to be when you stand in the presence of God? Whatever the author of Revelation, John, whatever John meant by standing face to face with God, whatever that is, I think it's a metaphor. I think it's a metaphor of intimacy. But what will be our reaction when we stand before a maximally beautiful being? Now, again, we can bring in other attributes, God's holiness. Wow, a perfectly holy being, perfectly righteous being. We can bring in other divine attributes, a being that possesses all power, all knowledge, is everywhere present, all of these omnis, if you will. But, you know, how striking is beauty? You know, think about some of the things you have looked at that you find beautiful. And then you'll stand before God and you'll see the source, the ground of all of that beauty. That kind of changed my way of thinking a little bit when I've reflected upon that, that I actually may be influenced a little differently than I initially thought when I stand before God. Guys, what's your thinking a little bit about that?
Yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
You know, I just think that it's going to be an amazing experience. I was always struck by a statement that C.S. Lewis made in Mere Christianity, that when the author walks onto the stage, you'll either be overwhelmed with an amazing presence of glory and blessing and love, or you'll be just horrified and want to, you know, crawl away. And depending on the choice that you made before the author walked onto the stage. And I think that's what is being reflected in part, at least in this beauty, as well as God's holiness.
You know, if you think a little bit about, I mean, hell is a controversial topic. It always has been, it always will be. It, of course, relates to the question of what is God's relationship to people who are not covered by the atonement of Christ.
Right.
And, you know, people, theologians and Christian apologists have talked a lot about what hell will be like. You know, the Bible uses metaphors like fire, darkness. It's also possible to think that part of the pain, the regret of hell, is never being able to have a relationship with God, God's love, God's beauty, never being able to have that kind of fulfilling experience. I don't know what it's going to be like, and I don't plan to be there. but I think that it could be. I mean, imagine if you will, and to some degree, I think all of us can imagine this, you know, imagine something that you are attracted to, something that you find of great value and you can't have it. That can be a very painful existence, but that's more of that in another program. Yeah. Let me also say that beauty is not something that merely Christians experience. Beauty is something that all human beings experience. And I would say that people are moved by beauty in almost a religious way, a visceral, mysterious way. I mean, I know some secular people, they would never go to church, but they love art museums. Beauty almost takes on a religiosity. I was watching a video of the Four Horsemen of the New Atheism. So you had Dawkins and Hitchens and Sam Harris and Dan Dennett, and they're kind of, it's almost a 2-hour video. You can find it on YouTube, but I watched a good bit of it because I thought I'd like to know, you know, the kind of things that they brought up. But it was interesting to me that at one point they said, look, we're not we're not necessarily saying as an atheist, you can't have spirituality. And I thought, whoa, this is kind of interesting. And when they began kind of describing spirituality, it was again, this kind of, this sense of, wow, there's something really beautiful here. Well, secular people have experiences. And again, I would describe them as visceral or mysterious. Now, let me give a little more definition to beauty here, if I could. And I'm going to quote from the Cardinal Newman Society. Newman was a Christian in the 19th century. He was an Anglican and later in life converted to Catholicism. And the Newman Society spends a lot of time talking about these transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty. In fact, you'll find this very common in Catholicism. When they talk about educating children, they talk about exposing them to truth, goodness, and beauty. Anyway, here's the Cardinal Newman Society. It says, quote, beauty can help evoke wonder and delight, which are foundations of a life of wisdom and inquiry. Beauty involves apprehending unity, harmony, proportion, wholeness, and radiance. It often manifests itself in simplicity and purity, especially in math and science. They continue, often beauty has a type of pre-rational striking force upon the soul. For instance, when one witnesses a spectacular sunset or the face of one's beloved, beauty can be understood as a type of inner radiance or shine coming from a thing that is well ordered to its state of being or is true to its nature or form. Well, you know, that's very powerful. You know, when you think about things that you find beautiful, you know, whether it is the face of your spouse or whether it is something in nature. I know with my wife, you know, she loves natural beauty. She loves beauty in nature, and she'll pull me out of the house to take a look at, you know, a sunset. I like that, but I also like Christian art. I like paintings. I like the art of Western civilization, but there's something that we see there. And from a Christian point of view, the idea would be, of course, because you're seeing a sense of beauty that comes from God. Now, let me at this point kind of transition. One philosopher that talks about beauty is Alexander Proust. The last name is spelled P-R-U-S-S. He's a Catholic philosopher, and he teaches at Baylor, which is a Baptist school. And Proust gave the Wild Lecture in 2019. That's a very prestigious series of lectures that are offered at Oxford University. And I listened to that very, very intently and carefully. You can go on YouTube and type in Alexander Proust, you know, beauty, and a lot of this will easily pop up for you. But guys, I want to give you what Proust talked about as the broad variety of beauty. He begins by talking about the beauty of character. And I think he mentions Mother Teresa, somebody who would sacrifice a lot in their life to care for people who are at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder in India. It's interesting that he talks about the beauty of character, right? I find my wife beautiful on the outside and on the inside. I've always been attracted to her. I like her hair. I like her pretty face, but I also like the character of my wife. There is an empathy. There is a movement to forgive that I don't find as easy to experience. But Proust goes on. He talks about physical beauty in nature, talks about beauty created by human beings in nature. He talks about visual beauty, abstract beauty of industrial design. Dave, he talks about mathematical beauty. He talks about non-visual, non-sensory beauty. You know, I think of the abstractions. I've always been fascinated by the idea that you can actually use mathematical equations to describe physical phenomena. He talks about beauty of poetry, both sound and idea. I think that's interesting. You know, I've written a few poems, and it's not only the ideas, but it's the rhyme. It's, you know, it's the way it sounds to the ear. He talks about beauty of proofs and arguments, beauty of the laws of nature, beauty of mathematical facts. My interest in C.S. Lewis kind of comes out at this point. C.S. Lewis wanted to be a poet. In fact, he thought he would likely be a war poet. Now, he never became a world-renowned poet, but his prose was so remarkable that he became a world-class author. But it's interesting to me that Lewis said that the memories of World War I were very difficult for him. Now, he didn't spend a lot of time talking about that. And I've noticed that my father wouldn't talk about his war experiences too easily either. I think if you let it out, it would overwhelm you. But Lewis said that, I'm going to put words in his mouth. I think Lewis suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he said the thing that helped him was reading poetry. Now, what's interesting there, guys, is this, is Jonathan Edwards. A lot of people who have never read Jonathan Edwards, of course, he's in the Reformed tradition. Many people would say that Edwards is arguably the greatest philosophical, theological thinker America ever produced. Now, he lived before America. He lived in the colonial period in the 1700s. A lot of people think, of course, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Actually, Edwards talks a lot more about beauty than he ever talked about hell. And he had an interesting argument, an interesting kind of concept or theory, if you will. He said that, human beings are fallen, and Edwards, of course, was reformed, and so he accepted the idea of total depravity, that at the fall, our entire being has been affected detrimentally by sin. So, you know, he says, look, the problem is with fallen human beings is we become we suffer from, being absorbed with ourself. And he said, the only thing that can take us away from that is beauty, particularly divine beauty. And, you know, think about that a little bit. You're looking at the sunset. Maybe you're at Zion National Park. Maybe you're out in the woods. I remember Hugh Ross saying that when he was at Caltech, Dave, you guys were both there together for a time. Hugh said that some of the science people were not interested in talking about religion or spirituality on campus during their involvement with the science school at Caltech. But, you know, when they're out there backpacking out in the middle of the wilderness, then ideas of spirituality and the meaning in the universe, they're more open and receptive. Well, think about this idea of beauty. Here's one for you. Maybe, I don't know what glorification is going to involve. My conception of it is, just as we've been justified and we are going through the process of sanctification, which in my case is long and difficult, But then there's glorification. We'll all be brought into the image of Christ, and I'll remain that way for all eternity. Is it possible that my self-obsession, and let me be very candid, there are times I find it hard to get out of myself. There are times where I find it difficult. Narcissism is easy for me to accept. Is it possible the beauty of God's being, and of course, part of the beauty of God's being is God's holiness, his righteousness, his truth, that will be the process that will take all of this fallenness away from me. Hmm. Now, we don't talk a lot about, or I don't think we talk as much about God's beauty as we do about God's truth and God's goodness. And I'm not necessarily saying that's wrongheaded. I think that truth does, in some sense, trump goodness and beauty. I mean, if Christianity isn't true, if God's existence is not true, then our discussion of goodness and beauty is not worthy of our time and attention. You guys want to jump in there? Can I go further?
Yeah, I just have a comment on beauty. I've been taking a lot of morning walks during the pandemic because there's nothing else to do, right? Right. No, there's plenty to do. But anyway, I've been trying to time my walks with the sunrise, or just before sunrise, actually, and I've seen some beautiful sunrises. And I tend to run into the same people out on the walking path. And sometimes we'll comment together, and I don't know their background, but it appears that all of us, as you mentioned earlier, can observe and appreciate beauty. And it's stunning because it changes from day to day, even from minute to minute. You can be talking to somebody and that sunrise will change just a little bit, especially if there are clouds, a few clouds there. It's really dramatic. But I guess what I'm saying, Ken, is that the people I talk to out there, they're seeing what I'm seeing. So it seems to be hardwired. As you said, it seems to be more objective because we're recognizing the same thing.
Yeah, you know, I think it's proper to say that there is an objective element to beauty. That is, all of us are aware that there's beauty out there, and it seems to be independent of us, even though we may be attracted, you know, to one element over another. They are seeing something. And then I want to put the seed in the mind of our listeners. If they're seeing something out there, is it possible we can use that in our evangelism and in our apologetics? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just, on multiple occasions, I've tried to communicate to my kids and my grandkids something about heaven, and the realization that what we see here in this life that we live is a shadow of what is going to be present in heaven. And in the course of talking about this, it always seems to come down to issues of beauty, the beauty of God's creation, and how that's just a taste, just a minor, in a sense, reflection or shadow of the glory that we're going to see when we go to heaven, when we are in his presence. Family relationships, one of the greatest blessings that we can experience here is personal relationships and the beauty of those family relationships. And that's just a barely beginning taste of the glory and the beauty of the relationships that we will experience when we're in God's presence.
You know, it's interesting. I was doing a little, there's a wilderness park not too far from my house where I live, and I go there regularly, and gets my heart pumping, and I get to look at nature a little bit. But I was hiking down the mountain there, a mountain. It's a big hill, I guess. But there was a guy taking, it was near sunset. So there was a guy with his telephone. I think for him, it was a camera that also you can call people on. But he was trying to take a picture of the sunset. You know, the sun was very red and it was beautiful. And I said, wow, that's, you know, I walked by him, but I said, wow, that's really beautiful. And, you know, he hardly even acknowledged. I could tell he was caught up in this. And, you know, that's the way beauty is. Another point I want to make about beauty is beauty can be dangerous. You know, one of the animals I find just fascinating are the big cats. And, you know, I think of a tiger. If you compare a tiger and a lion, it's really interesting that the tiger can weigh up to 800 pounds and they can stand on their back feet and fight. Lions are effective because they come in, you know, a pack. They've got a group and they attack you that way. But, you know, I'd like to pet a tiger, but I'm afraid he might quickly put my head in his mouth. you know, I also think of nature. I wonder if at times people don't get lost in the wilderness regions because they just love that beauty, but are not paying enough practical attention to the idea that, you know, mountainous regions can be very dangerous.
Yes.
So here you have this mixture of it's alluring to us. It draws us in, but you also have to be very careful. I'm hoping maybe in the new heaven and the new earth, maybe I'll be able to, you know, pet one of these tigers and you know, he won't chomp on my head. Before I move to make the argument for God and beauty, I simply want to make one point about Christians and the branches of Christendom and beauty. You know, for example, in the Orthodox tradition and in the Catholic tradition, I think that you largely have, you have an approach to beauty that is different. For example, in the Orthodox tradition, they use icons. And these icons are painted by some of the world's greatest artists of the time. And they create these images of, could be the Trinity, but it could also be the Virgin Mary or Jesus or one of the saints. And they use these icons as a means of, you know, prompting the idea of seeing heavenly realities. And of course, Catholics have, you know, these very powerful statues. I remember growing up Catholic and, you know, the church I was baptized in, I remember looking at the crucifix and noticing the crucified Christ. And it was like, wow, you know, this is suffering that I'm not familiar with. Well, Protestants, as part of their reaction, I think, largely to the Catholic Church, but probably as well to the Orthodox tradition, they have a much more, they have less visual art and more audio art. You know, in some Protestant churches, the only art you would have would be music. And of course, Calvin, probably the greatest systematic theologian of the Protestant Reformation, one of the famous quotes from Calvin is that the mind of man is a human idolatry factory. And so that kind of reaction, you go into Presbyterian and Reformed churches, art's very sparse. Now, the Anglican tradition is a little different, Lutheran a little different. There's more stained glass. So there is kind of a difference when it approaches these kinds of things. But again, I would make the comment, if you think the Orthodox and Catholics go too far, is it possible Protestants have overreacted? Because again, when I go into the Anglo-Catholic churches, I think, wow, the incredible beauty of these kinds of things. So that's one of the ways in which Christendom has very differing ideas about how beauty is to be done. Okay, now I want to make an argument. I want to talk about this abductive argument. And again, the way I'm reasoning is simply this. I believe that beauty fits better in a world with God than in a world without God. And we have an abundance of beauty, and we have an abundance of varieties of beauty. We live in a beauty abundant universe. And I think that fits better with God than without God. And I would say this, the secular worldview of naturalism says that God does not exist and that life in this world is the product of mindless, unguided, natural evolutionary processes. You know, you've got matter and time and chance. That's difficult for me to conceive of how beauty would be in the mix. In fact, you could ask this question. I think it's a good one. Given naturalism, so nature is the whole show, the material, physical universe is all there is. Given naturalism, why should an impersonal and meaningless universe care about beauty? Seems foreign to me. It seems that beauty doesn't quite fit. And so I'm now going to make that case, and I'm going to simply put it in this context, that given naturalism, evolution runs exclusively on the track of survivability. But now the question is, how does the mechanism of naturalistic evolution driven by survivability produce artistic beauty when aesthetics doesn't seem to contribute to survivability? Now again, you can put it another way. Why so much beauty in a world where beauty doesn't seem to contribute significantly to survivability? In philosophy, we call this the problem of non-utilitarian or non-useful values. Now, I think that's a very interesting, idea. How does beauty help you survive? And it doesn't seem clear to me that beauty is directly tied to survivability, but I want to come back to that because I know there are people who think that it does, and I don't want to rule that out. But I do want to make the argument, and here I'm going to appeal to a philosopher, Christian philosopher, William C. Davis. This is a chapter in the book Reasons for the Hope Within. It's edited by Michael Murray. And this is what Davis says, and he's making the argument now. He says, quote, "If everything, including humanity, is the result of random impersonal forces, which encouraged only survival, then it seems highly unlikely that the process would yield organisms, namely humans, which recognize values like these, artistic beauty, which aren't survival conducive." Now, Davis adds a point that I think is very important in terms of this inference to the best explanation when it comes to what is the better explanation, naturalism or theism. Davis says this, he says, quote, "But values like these, artistic beauty, are what we would expect if humans and the human environment were created by a personal, loving, and beauty-valuing God. God's existence is a much better explanation for the existence of non-utilitarian value than any explanation without God." So again, just kind of thinking about this argument, which worldview seems to make the most sense of beauty? Again, Davis here is arguing that not only is beauty seemingly foreign in a world without God, and particularly it doesn't seem to be survival conducive, but then he's making the case that if you posit Christianity or the Christian worldview, that's exactly what you would expect. Now let me give you another philosopher here. This is Paul Copan. Paul's been a guest on Straight Thinking. I really like Paul. His books are very helpful to me. He has a book entitled Loving Wisdom that is kind of a go-to book for me. If there is a philosophy of religion idea that I want to pursue, Copan is one of the first people on my list. Listen to what Copan says. And again, he's following in the path of Davis. They're both Christian thinkers. Copan says, impressive natural beauty is in no way linked to survival. So why think this overwhelming beauty should exist given naturalism? Why isn't everything functional, monotonously textured in battleship gray color? Now, he makes the same point that Davis makes. He then says, and why should human creatures exist who can admire and appreciate the world's loveliness and majesty? And why do scientists prefer elegant or beautiful theories, often without observational support? Now, again, that is essentially the idea that beauty makes more sense in a world with God than a world without God. Now, I don't want to just quote Christian thinkers here. There are even some secular thinkers who agree with this. One of them is Paul Draper. Paul Draper is a leading philosopher. He's a secularist. I don't know if he's an agnostic or an atheist, but he's definitely secular and a strong critic of Christian theism. He's debated William Lane Craig, for example, on the question, I think it was on the God question. Well, here's what Draper says. This is from a book. He has a chapter in Divine Hiddenness. And this is an interesting book, by the way, guys. It has Jews, Christians, and secularists all kind of responding to why does God appear to be hidden? But this is what Draper says. Theism is supported by the fact that the universe contains an abundance of beauty. So even a secularist, he also makes that point that Davis and Copan have made. He says, quote, a beautiful universe, especially one containing beings that can appreciate that beauty, is clearly more likely on theism than on naturalism. I mean, think about what humans do. Humans create beauty. They uncover beauty. They appreciate beauty. Think about how meaningful music is to so many people. Think about how attracted people are to the national parks. Think about how meaningful the attraction, the romantic attraction from one person is to the other. Again, I want to come back to that question in just a couple minutes about does beauty contribute to survival? Because not everybody's going to agree with Davis and Copan here. But here's another atheist. This is Anthony O'Hare in his book, Beyond Evolution. Notice what he says. He says, quote, from a Darwinian perspective, truth, goodness, and beauty and our care for them are very hard to explain. So here is an atheist, and he's looking at it from the lens of Darwinian evolution, and he recognizes the transcendentals, and he says those transcendentals and our connection, our care for them, our love for them, our interest in them is very hard to explain.
You know, let me just make a comment. You know, when you look at that tiger, they're incredibly beautiful. And you can explain the presence of all the striping and so on the tiger as being part of the survival of the tiger. In other words, he being a hunter in an environment is camouflaged by the stripes and so on that he has. So the fact of the tiger having those stripes seems, at least can be explained in terms of a survival mechanism. But why would I think, looking at that tiger, that it's beautiful?
Yeah. And that might cause you to be extinct, Dave. You know, you might forget to run. And I would even say I'm willing to entertain the idea more that beauty could contribute to survivability more than Davis and Copan would be. You know, I mean, think about attracting a mate, luring prey. You know, it could be that there is some elements of beauty that contribute to survivability. I was interacting with a guy on Facebook, and you know, he was bringing up the idea that maybe the pleasure that we experience in beauty helps us to survive. That is, it enhances our our humanity. Now, again, I'm not sure what to do with all of that. I don't necessarily want to simply say it doesn't have some survival advantage, but I would be willing to say this. It just seems like there's way too much beauty. And still, even if beauty does contribute to survivability, I think it's a better fit. It's a better fit in theism. And again, I'd simply bring us back to that abductive reasoning again. What is the best explanation? And if I could put it into an argument now, and let me again say, you know, in logic, you have kind of three ways of thinking, or three ways of arguing: deduction. If you do that properly, you get certainly true conclusions. Then you have induction. If you do that properly, you get probably true conclusions. But if you engage in abductive reasoning, then you're talking not about certainty or probability, you're talking about plausibility. What is the best explanation? And that idea is, again, this diagnostician, you know, how do I explain the phenomenon? Well, here's how you set up an abductive argument. Yeah. The first two statements are my premises. My third one is the conclusion. So here's an abductive argument. You could frame it this way. Point one, the extraordinary experience of X is recognized. Point two, but if A is true, X would be an expected matter of course. Three, conclusion, thus there is a plausible reason for concluding A is true. Now let me plug that in to beauty. So my first premise would be the extraordinary experience, the abundance and variety of beauty is recognized. And I think it is. I think it's universal. I think you're going to find it hard to find somebody who says, nah, music, it's just noise. I don't like any music. I don't like any art at all. No, the extraordinary experience, the abundance and variety of beauty is recognized. Premise two, but if a theistic God exists, beauty would be an expected matter of course. Conclusion, thus there is a plausible reason to conclude a theistic God exists. So even if I concede that there may be some contribution that beauty can make to survivability, it seems to me that the abundance of beauty and particularly the human capacity to detect beauty and derive pleasure from it fits a lot better in a world with God than in a world without God. So what do you think of this what do you think of this argument?
Yeah, well, I'm struck by those two comments from the philosophers, I think Draper and O'Hare, just the fact that they admitted so much that beauty fits better on theism than on naturalism. And I forgot the exact wording of the other one, but I just like the fact that they are struck, and these are people who are thinking about these things, and maybe that's a good launching point or a branch that we can have with the non-Christian.
And that I think, Joe, is a very, I mean, that's where I want to go in our next program. I mean, but let me lay it out here just briefly. I wonder if the beauty argument is an underutilized idea, and I'm simply entertaining the idea that we know that our secular friends, they're not terribly interested in our arguments, but they are interested in beauty. Now, again, could it be that we're underutilizing that? And then I would also raise the question, is it possible that beauty is underutilized even in the Christian experience? I mean, I think we talk more about truth and goodness than we do beauty. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me a very engaging and powerful idea.
Yeah, I would like to try it. I've tried out every other argument with my atheist friends. I'd like to try this one out. I'll let you know how it comes out.
I predict a beautiful outcome.
Well, let me, Joe, let me simply give some sources. I've mentioned a few, but let me kind of go through them again. I talk a little bit about this kind of reasoning, this best explanation thinking in primarily in two of my books, Seven Truths That Changed the World and A World of Difference. But I also want to say in my new book that hopefully will be released soon, Christianity Cross-Examined, I have some discussion of this beauty argument in there. But again, I want to remind some of the quotations that we have we've made from. I want to draw people's attention to Paul Draper, and particularly Anthony O'Hare as well, along with Draper's section is in Divine Hiddenness, and then Paul Copan in his book Loving Wisdom, and William C. Davis in his a chapter in the book, Reasons for the Hope Within.
All right. Good stuff to get us going. Thank you for that, Ken. I'm looking forward to the next podcast, and I'm sure Dave is as well. Thank you for your comments and insights on this one. Let us know what's on your mind and send us your comments and questions. You can reach Ken at RTB_case samples. That's the usual way. Others of you have found him on social media and have been replying to his Facebook posts or Twitter. So thank you for that. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Look for the Reasons to Believe podcast and you'll find Straight Thinking there. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.